Okay. Yeah. As I said to those who were on in the beginning, a different room, I hope the internet holds out. If it does not, then we get whatever we get until then. But I'll wish everybody a Shana Tova, a Ksiva V'Chasima Tova at this point, in case I'm not able to wish it at the end. Okay. So, first I wanted to go back to Eti's question from last time. We had talked about the Aron and the location of the Aron, because back in the beginning of the book, in chapter 4, the Plishtim got the Aron. It was returned in chapter 6, and there was a problem where it went to Beit Shemesh, and they were suffering. They were being punished, we said, because they didn't treat the Aron properly, or because they didn't go after the Aron among the Plishtim. And the Aron ended up in a place called Kiryat Ya'arim, in the house of Avinadav. And there it stayed, and that was why it was relevant. It stayed there for a long time, including when apparently when the Mishkan was in Nov, as it is in the chapter that we're on right now. So Eti asked, is Avinadav special, such that the Aron is able to stay with him without, you know, some kind of suffering, without some kind of harm? So I looked back at my notes from the end of chapter 6, beginning of chapter 7, and there we had asked the question of why the people of Kiryat Ya'arim accepted the Aron in the first place. Meaning, it's already frozen. Are we frozen already? Okay, so we are back, and God willing, internet should hold out for the rest. So we had asked the question at the time in chapter 7 of why people in Kiryat Ya'arim were okay accepting the Aron. Why weren't they worried that something would happen to them the same way it had happened to other hosts of the Aron? So one answer that we gave is that if you look closely at the beginning of chapter 7, you find, as Abarbanel suggests, that maybe the people of Kiryat Ya'arim were actually asked to take the Aron before the plague hit in Beit Shemesh. So they didn't realize what they were getting into. That explains why they went for it. However, most do not agree with Abarbanel's read. And instead, you have to suggest that Kiryat Ya'arim thought they knew better how to take care of the Aron. So if you flip back to chapter 7, sentence 1, you'll notice something that may give us a clue. The pasuk says, "Vayavo anshei Kiryat Ya'arim." The people of Kiryat Ya'arim came. "Vayalu es Aron Hashem, vayaviu oso el beis Avinadav bagivah." They brought up the Ark of God. They brought it to the house of Avinadav in Givah. "Ves Elazar beno Kiddushu lishmor es Aron Hashem," and they dedicated his son Elazar. Kiddushu can be dedicated, can be consecrated, but they dedicate Elazar to guard the Aron of Hashem. So it's possible to suggest that maybe this dedication of Elazar was what was important. It could be that the dedication of Elazar was what was special and made Kiryat Ya'arim eligible to take care of the Aron. You follow? I don't hear anyone.
Did we hear from him?
We did in Iraq.
I couldn't make out a word you said.
Really?
It was,
That's interesting. Ricky heard me.
Never hear from Elazar afterwards?
Nope. We know nothing about him. We know nothing about him.
Do we know that he was a Kohen?
Nope. We have no such information. So the only thing we do know is that the text goes out of its way to say they actually set somebody up to take care of the Aron, and maybe that in and of itself demonstrates loyalty to the Aron, and therefore it is valued. It's possible. You can make the argument. Whether it has to be so, I don't know, but it could be so. Otherwise, I don't have an answer. So that's the best I have. Hang on 1 second. Let's stop that. Sorry, I just need to figure out. Hold on 1 second. There we go. Okay.
Not going anywhere.
Nope. But there we go. Now we're good. Okay. So, with all of that behind us, let's turn back to chapter 21. So, as chapter 21 begins, we are again, as we said last time, after the decision by Yonatan to let David go, David has run away. Vayakam vayonasan babair. David ran, he left, and Yonatan came into the city, which presumably the city is going to be Gibeah, which is where Shaul has his capital. I wanted to note something that we also mentioned last year at the end of June, and I brought it for you in source number 1 on the sheet. Remember that in chapter 19, we said that Yehonatan wants to keep both David and Shaul. That's what Yonatan would like to be able to do. He wants to keep his relationship with his father. That's very important to him. And he also wants to keep his relationship with David. And he tries to create peace with them. He gets his father to swear an oath that he's not going to hurt David. That's his goal. We also saw that David's test, I'm sorry, that was chapter 19. At the start of chapter 20, we saw Yehonatan insist to David that peace would hold between them. Even as David said, Shaul wants to kill me. And what we said in chapter 20 was that when David is testing Shaul, if I'm absent, is Shaul going to be angry or not? It was also a test of Yehonatan. Will Yehonatan be loyal to David or to Shaul? And we saw that Yehonatan, you know, again is trying to keep them both, and he tries to calm down his father and he fails. And so that it looks like at the end of the chapter, he has lost both of them. He lost Shaul, who rebuked him publicly in this very harsh way, right? You remember that?
We can't hear you.
Again? Seriously?
I can hear you.
No. Some people hear me, if some people don't, then it's not on my end. Okay. So, yeah, as long as some people can hear me, we're I guess, okay. I apologize, though, to those who can't, but it's apparently that's not on this end, then. So, Yehonatan seems to be losing Shaul, and also to be losing David, who has to flee. However, there's a little bit of redemption. First of all, in terms of David, at the end of chapter 20, we said that David cries more than Yehonatan does, right? There were different reads of that sentence when it said David cried more, but Rashi and Radak read it as David cried more than Yehonatan, showing that he is still loyal to him. There is still affection, there is still allegiance. Rav Amnon Bazak notes that if you take a look at the opening sentence in our chapter, chapter 21, sentence 1, where we said Yehonatan Babair, Yehonatan came into the city, those words were not really necessary. You didn't have to say Yehonatan came into the city. Obviously he went into the city, right? I mean, where else was he going to go? What, Susan?
He could have gone with David to let us know that he didn't follow David.
But we know he didn't go with David. I'm not asking why he didn't do it. I'm asking why the text doesn't say, I'm asking why the text says what he did. You're right, he could have gone with David, he didn't go with David, and we take that as a very serious point. But the fact that the text actually tells us that he chooses to go into the city is what's important. There's a fly buzzing around here. If it's not Zoom, it's a fly. It's always something. So take a look at what Rav Bazak does with that in source number 1. He says, Vayakom vayelech v'yonatan ba ba'ir. David went, and Yonatan came into the city. So he says, Pasuk ze mechadeid es ha'uvda shebesofo shel davar lo halach Yonatan im David. This text is sharpening the point that in the end, Yonatan did not go with David. El chazar ha'ira, he went back to the city. Yitachein shaloi sakan bichlal efsherut acheret. It could be he doesn't have another choice. Could be. Vein lahalos al adash Yonatan amur yal aleches im David lihisnat take me aviv. You can't really suggest that Yonatan should have gone with David and cut ties with his father. That we would
make it obvious. To make it obvious to his father that he would be seen in the city, so that his father will be certain that he did not go with David. If he went someplace obscure and people didn't see him, then his father could think that he went with David.
That's interesting. So Ricky suggests that maybe the text is making the point that he goes to the city so that his father will see that he's there. But keep in mind, his father does not know that he's been with David until now. His father isn't.
At least he'll know where he is.
He'll know where he is. My father will know where I am. Could be. Well, I'm with Rav Bazak on this one. It's stronger than that. He says, "Avol b'shura tachtona." Bottom line, "B'pasuk zecho reitz Yonatan es goralo shelo." With this line, Yonatan seals his lot. Now he is with his father, and "Kevan shekarach es goralo b'goral aviv v'lo b'zeh shel David." Everything that's going to happen to Yonatan going forward up to his death in battle alongside his father is because of the decision that he makes right now. He is now with his father and he's going to go down with the ship. As opposed to surviving to see David become king and helping him when David is king. And that's where he goes on to say, as we said, last June, that when David says in his eulogy for Shaul and Yonatan, he describes them as never being separated, right? Even in their death, they weren't separated. Usually we take that as this praise, and it is praise. However, he's also perhaps saying he didn't separate from his father, and that's why I lost him. There's that side to it as well. So, that's in terms of Yehonatan. Now we shift our focus to David, and like I said last week, this chapter is the David show. Unlike other chapters that have multiple people who are focused at different points, this chapter is David. Yes, Susan.
We're not supposed to let ourselves die. We're supposed to keep ourselves alive.
Yes.
Yonatan knew the chances were high he was going to die because he knew God ordained David to be the Melech. I'm not sure. I mean, I see Kibbutz of the aim, and he went with his father. But I don't really understand why he didn't go with David.
So I don't know that he knows that death is coming. He knows that the monarchy is going to David. But I don't know that he thinks that means that he's going to have to that he'd have to die, or that Shaul would even have to die. You know, his hope all along has been to make a peace treaty between Shaul and David. So I don't know that he thinks he's going to die as a result.
Because I know he knows it's impossible at this point.
Well, yes, but Yonatan is an optimist.
Yeah,
that's clear.
They didn't know they were going to die on Narea Bilboa.
I'm sorry, what, Eti?
They didn't know they were going to die
right.
on Narea Bilboa. They went
Correct.
To fight.
Correct. Bonita, you were going to say? You're muted.
Do they see each other again after
yes.
this?
Yep, chapter 23.
Because I was thinking this was the final.
Right, it's not final. Chapter 23 will be, they'll see each other, yeah.
I was thinking that maybe it's some kind of foreshadow for what comes next, that we can be sure what comes next. Yonatan had nothing to do with it. Mm. Or Yonatan was not involved and did stay loyal to David in some way.
But by saying he goes back to the city, I would think that actually implicates him in what comes next, because the problems that he faces come from the city.
But that the story gets related to Saul.
Yeah.
What happened in Nov would the fact that that Jonathan wasn't there sort of means that he had nothing to do with it.
But wasn't where?
He wasn't with David.
Right.
He was in the city.
Right.
So he had nothing to do with what happened in Nov.
But being in the city means he's with Shaul.
Yeah, but he didn't get the message to Shaul about what happened.
Oh, okay. I hear that. I mean, the text is going to be very clear that Doeg is the one who does it. And he's,
right.
Yeah. Okay.
I just think it's natural for him to go back to, he's not going to blatantly rebel against his father. He saved Jonathan. I don't know, David, I don't know if there's anything to be gained by his joining David.
No, that's 100%. As Rav Bazak wrote, it's not that we're surprised that he did that. It's that the text goes out of its way to say he did that. So the question is, what are we supposed to learn from there? That's what this is about. Okay.
I think there is a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah? You would have expected Yonatan to go with David?
Well, there is a little bit of a surprise. I do agree with Rav Bazak. I think that this was very, very important, that first pasuk. That it said that to let us know that he made a wrong decision that impacted his life. At the same time, I keep it in my mind that Pirkei Avos brings Yonatan and David's love for each other as a love that endures. So he certainly didn't mean to be going against David.
For sure.
But it was just a defining moment in his life, and unfortunately defined it the wrong way.
Right. No, I mean,
I was surprised.
He's definitely not breaking with David, but he's lost him.
Yeah.
Yes. Ruth, and then we're going to go further, because everything we've done so far is review, which isn't a bad thing. Review is important. But I'd also like to add something new in honor of Rosh Hashanah. Yes, Ruth.
Yonatan, he loved David, but he also loved his father.
Yes.
So he went to David, and he warned him, and he knew that David had run away, so hopefully he would be safe. And then he went to join his father.
All true.
I don't know that he knew there would be kind of open warfare.
No, all true, and there is, and 100% true. I mean, there isn't open warfare; it's really one-sided. Shaul pursuing David to kill him, but the emphasis here and the point that I'm trying to get across is not about why Yonatan did what he did, but why the text takes the time to tell us that. That's all. So let's take a look at sentences 2-4. In this, we are going to find David tell his second lie in order to escape Shaul. His first lie was in the previous chapter when he told Yonatan to tell his father that he was missing because he was at a family sacrifice in order to give his alibi or his excuse for not being there. He's going to tell a second lie now in order to get support from Achimelech, who is running the Mishkan. So let's take a look first at the sentences, and then we'll have a lot to discuss. Vayavo David Nove. David came to Nov, and as we said last week, Nove just means to Nov. Don't get hung up on it. David came to Nov. El Achimelech HaKohen. To Achimelech the priest. And not only is he the priest, Radak and Abarbanel take it as a given. Achimelech is the priest. He's the Kohen Gadol. He is the high priest. He's not just the person manning the desk. Interestingly, Professor Kiel in the Dot Mikra has a suggestion about Achimelech's identity. Go back to chapter 14, sentence 3, please. This is during the war against the Plishtim, the war that Yehonatan won, basically, for everybody. The one with the oath about not having the honey and or not eating, and then he had the honey and so on. So when they are when they're there in the camp initially, right? You see that in chapter 14. So in sentence 2, we're told where Shaul is, and he's got 600 men with him. And then we're told in sentence 3, Achiyah, son of Achituv, the brother of Ikavod ben Pinchas ben Eli. Okay? So Achiyah is the son of Achituv, who is the brother of Ikavod, who is the son of Pinchas. When we did this back in chapter 14, we had to spend a lot of time just understanding the generations. But here's the key. Some of you who were with us back when we did chapter 4 will remember. When the Aron was taken by the Plishtim, Chofni and Pinchas were killed. A runner came back with the news and told, number one, Eli, but also, who found out? Do you remember? Who else found out there with catastrophic results?
The wife of Pinchas.
Right, the wife of Pinchas, who was expecting. And she gave birth and died in childbirth, right? We had a whole discussion about that, the association between Pinchas' wife who dies in childbirth and Rachel who dies in childbirth, and Michal bat Shaul, who may have died in childbirth as well. That was a matter. So we connected all three of them. But the point is this. She names her son, who she gives birth to there, Ikavod. Right? Ichabod in English. Ikavod means disgrace. Not a great name you want to give somebody. So Ricky, I see you unmuted, but I want to go through this. So the point is that back in chapter 14, we were told that Ikavod actually had an older brother. His older brother was Achituv. And Achituv had a son, Ikavod's nephew, in other words. And that son is serving as the Kohen of God in Shiloh, bearer of the Ephod, possibly, as we said back then, Kohen Gadol. So Professor Kiel, in the Dot Mikra, says, that person back there who was the Kohen serving there, descendant of Eli, was named Achiyah. That's probably the same person here as Achimelech. We do that with names. You find that with names in Navi. That's not unique to this case. So Professor Kiel suggests it's the same person. The Kohen back with the Ephod back in chapter 14 is the Kohen Gadol in Nov. In chapter 21, Achiyah and Achimelech are the same person. You follow? Okay. So what happened? David came to Nov, to Achimelech, the Kohen, Vayecherad Achimelech likras David, and Achimelech trembles, he shakes, he's shocked to greet David. He's shaking. Vayomerlo, he says, Madua televadecha, why are you alone? The ish ain't itach, and there's nobody with you. What's wrong? Meaning, you're the king's son-in-law. You're chief officer, or certainly high-up soldier in the army. Why are you just, like, walking into the Mishkan alone? Something must be wrong. Unclear to me whether he knows about anything between Shaul and David. Some people did know. Right? Shaul told his servants about his plan in some way. We had that whole discussion about what exactly he told them. But the assumption is that some people know, unclear what he knows, but he knows something's wrong because David is walking into the Mishkan on his own. Yes, Ruth. So if that's true, Ruth suggests that maybe he's actually saying, you know, you should have protection with you, and he's siding with David. If that's true, David doesn't know it. Because David is going to act in this chapter as though Achimelech has no idea at all, as you'll see very, very shortly. David is going to act as though Achimelech thinks he is a loyal soldier of Shaul. So watch what he says to Achimelech. Sentence 3. Vayomer David l'Achimelech ha-Kohen. David says to Achimelech, Hamelech tzivani davar. the king has commanded me to do something. I am on a mission from Shaul. Vayomer Eli, and Shaul said to me, Ish al yeda me'uma es hadavar asher anochi sholeichacha v'asher tzivisicha. Nobody should know anything about this mission. I'm on a secret mission. I'm not allowed to tell anybody anything. Ve'es hane'arim, and as far as the youths who are with me, I'm not alone on this mission. I have people with me. But yodati el mekomploni almoni. Them, I sent them off to another place. I sent them off to a place, ploni almoni, hang in there, Claudette. Ploni almoni. Yodati is an odd word. Most commentators take it to mean, I told them to go there, informed them. Rashi takes it as, I burdened them. If you remember in Sefer Shoftim, the story where Gideon punishes the people of Penuel and Sukkot, for not supporting him when he was chasing after Midian. So in one of them, I forget which one, I think it was Sukkot, it says Vayoda es anshei Sukkot. And it's referring to the punishment that he delivered upon them. So Rashi says that here, that it's either I burdened them by telling them to go to this place, Ploni Almoni, or I told them to go. In terms of the words Ploni Almoni, some of you learned Ruth with me last year. So the Ploni Almoni doesn't mean any place. It means a place that must not be named. Ploni, we're taught from the word pele, meaning something that is beyond speech, and almoni from elaim, to be mute. We saw that in Rashi on root. Radak says it here. They leave aside the etymological question. It's very clear. It means a place that must not be named. Just as we said with Ploni Almoni in root, that because he is working against the narrative of the book, he's not willing to help out. He's not willing to provide chesed. He's not loyal. And he's acting against the lineage that will produce King David. So therefore, he cannot be named in the book of Ruth. There's a similar use in Malachim, which I gave you in source number 3. You could take a look at it if you want. But Ploni Almoni means this is a place that must not be named. We are on a secret mission. Okay, Ruth, you were going to say? No, not Ruth, sorry, Claudette, you were going to say.
Yeah. Is it possible that David, can you hear me?
Yes.
That David's lie is not so much about him as protecting Abimelech from Shaul's wrath.
So if he's trying to protect Ahimelech, he does a really bad job. Meaning, I hear what you're saying. In other words, what you're suggesting is, if Ahimelech thinks that he's helping a servant of Shaul, he has an alibi. Later on, when they come to him and say, why did you help David? He's going to say, because he told me he was on a mission from you. Right?
So he's giving him an alibi.
Right. So it's a nice idea for sure, and unfortunately, entirely ineffective. It's not going to work. He is going to get hurt, and everybody in the city is going to get hurt. If you jump ahead to chapter 22, sentence 13. Sentence 14. Sorry, sentence 14. Ahimelech is going to say to the king, you know, David is your loyal man. No one's more loyal than he is. I would never want to do anything and all that, and yet he gets killed as the sentences continue. So it could be David is trying to help him, but he's not succeeding. That's what I'll say. Okay, so that's sentence 3. Question. Why does David say specifically that it's a secret mission? Why does he stress that it's a secret mission?
He doesn't want to say any more. He doesn't want to elaborate on this.
Why not? No, I mean, we know why he doesn't want to say what's actually going on. But why doesn't he say, I have a mission. I have been told to go to war against Edom or something. Yeah, Janine.
When he says he doesn't want word to get out to Shaul as to where he's located.
But why doesn't he say, I am on a mission to go to fight against Ammon? And in fact, he goes the other direction. Like, why does he say it's a secret mission specifically?
Well, it makes it sound like he's in good terms with the Shah. The Shah is sending him on a...
Make him sound like he's on good terms with him? Okay, that could be. He's trusted. Ruth, and then Claudette.
If it's a secret mission, then maybe he won't say anything to anybody, so no one will know that he's there.
He's worried about the Cohen Guttle blabbing?
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe. It's an interesting possibility.
If he doesn't think it's something complicated, right. Why would he say
that? It also explains why he's alone.
Right. Not just why, but Professor Keel in Dot Mikra notes, it explains why he has no food and why he has no weapons. This is a rush job. I was told to race out and just go do, and now I'm, you know, getting everything together, as you'll see. Ricky. No, you just muted yourself.
Just unmuted. Okay. He is mentioning Shaul's name without anything, saying anything negative about him, so that people will know that he's still with him, that he is not parted ways with him.
Right, but that doesn't explain why he has to say it's a secret mission. He could have said, Shaul sent me to do X. That's the thing. Sandra, you were going to say? I thought? No? Okay, Claudette?
I come back to what Abimelech knows, and I think if a mission was going to happen, Abimelech would have known. So David has to emphasize that it's a secret, so he does, you know, everybody doesn't know about it.
But again, he could have said that it was a mission to some other nation. So I'll tell you what I think is going on. David is going to do three things here. Number one, he's going to get food. Number two, he's going to get a weapon. But he's also going to ask Achimelech and the Urim V'Tumim that he wears, the Choshen, what is going to happen going forward. Will he succeed on his path? That's one of the questions David is going to have. If he doesn't say it's a secret mission, he has to explain his question to God. This way, this is Ralbag, this way, David has an excuse for asking the question in a vague way, just asking, will I succeed on the path that I am going, without having to say anything. That he doesn't want to lie when he asks the question of the Urim V'Tumim and say, will I succeed in my war against Ammon? That would be bad. So he'd rather say nothing, and this is his justification. But look at what happens in sentence 4 now. Sentence 4. Back in chapter 21, we are in sentence 4. And now he says to Achimelech, Ma yesh tachas yadcha? What do you have in hand? What do you have available? Chamisha lechem, 5 loaves of bread. Tnavi adi, give them into my hand. O animza, or whatever you have around. You know, I need food. So if you have, you know, 5 rolls around, that would be great. I read an article by Rav Bazak in which he argued that the way to read this sentence is actually as a dialogue. David says, what do you have under your hand? And Achimelech says to him, 5 loaves. And David says back to him, give it in my hand or whatever you have. It's a creative read. He says that that's true of other psukim as well, other passages around Tanakh. But let me ask you a question.
Why would he specifically ask for 5?
Yeah. Right, so that's clearly what's bothering Rav Bazak, right? Why would David ask for 5 rolls? You tell me, why would he ask for 5 rolls? I have some funny answers to this question. Why would David ask for 5 rolls? Because Shabbos is coming up, and he wants Lechem Mishnah for Friday night, he wants 2 loaves again for the day, and then he's going to not use one of them, and then he'll use that for Shalosh Hodesh, so he can have, you know, proper meals. What in the world is 5 loaves? So, one answer is logical, and that's the Malbim's answer. The only problem is, I can't find his source. Malbim says, "V'David amar le'shiyiten lo chamisha lechem." David said to him to give him 5 loaves. Ki ha'kohen gadol hayanotel chamesh chalos kamo shekasev biyuma. We're going to be talking about. We won't get to it this week, so it'll have to be for when we come back to doing Shmuel. Remember the shiur on Tzom Gedalia, which is the day after Rosh Hashanah, not the day of Rosh Hashanah. The shiur next Thursday, in other words, is going to be about Tzom Gedalia. And then we're going to be off until after Sukkot. So in the shiur after Sukkot, we'll be talking a lot more about the following. But David gets bread from Achimelech, and according to one school of thought, the bread he gets is the Lechem HaPanim, is the show bread. There was bread that went on a special table in the Mishkan, put out on Shabbos, left there the whole week, and on Shabbos you take away the old bread and it's divided up among the Kohanim. So the Malbim says, the Kohen Gadol gets 5 loaves of bread. And that's what David was asking for. My problem is that I have no source saying that the Kohen Gadol gets 5 loaves of bread. I don't know where Malbim is getting this from. The closest I could come to is source number 5, which is a Tosefta in Yuma. Tosefta is material that is roughly contemporary to the Mishnah, but was not canonized in the Mishnah. Susan, what's wrong?
No, I have something on this, why it's showbread, why the number.
So hang in there for a second. The Tosefta says, how is it? Ketzev Kohen Gadol nota chelek merosh. We have a principle that the Kohen Gadol gets first from the offerings. What does that mean? So he could say, if there's a particular sin offering, I'm going to be the one to do the service and get the Kohen portion from it. This is not like Chofni and Pinchas, who demand to get stuff, you know, before anybody else gets, and who demand to get things, you know, before blood is even put on the Mizbeach. Not like that. The Kohen Gadol has the right to say, I'm going to do this service and get the Kohen portion. And he's able to say, I'm getting 4 or 5 loaves from the showbread. So that's the closest I can come to the Malbim, is this source that says that he has the right to take 4 or 5 loaves. Fine. Susan, I want you to hold off on what you have until we get to see what I have. Then if you have something additional, fine.
Okay, something before.
Yeah.
They say that Mitzvah David put it in the question. It wasn't a statement. If you have 5 loaves.
Yeah.
It wasn't, give me 5 loaves, but if you've got that,
I
still have an explanation, but I'll wait for one.
Okay. But that read of the line, while very Canadian, I don't think is true to the text. When you say to somebody, Tanabiyadi means put it in my hand. That's what it means. It doesn't say, could you please?
That's a V, not me.
Yeah, okay. But that's one possibility. Malbim offers another possibility, which is practical, and I like it a lot more. He says, oh, you know what? I didn't bring it on here. Okay. But his practical suggestion is that this is part of David's subterfuge. David claimed to have five youths with him. So he says, give me 5 because I have these other guys I have to feed. It's not just for me. So Susan, that's what your book has. That's Malbim's second idea.
Pretty close to it.
But then Abarbanel has 2 very strange explanations. It's really one explanation that you can divide in 2. Take a look at source number 6. V'hine sha'al chamisha lechem. David asked for 5 loaves. K'neged chamisha chumshei Torah. Parallel to the 5 chumashim. I don't know what to make of that. There are 6 orders of the Mishnah. Why didn't David ask for that? There are 24 books in Tanakh. Maybe he should have asked for 24. Well, David didn't know all the books in Tanakh yet. He hadn't written Tehillim yet. But it's out of nowhere. I mean, there are 13 attributes of Hashem, so he should have asked for 13. I don't know what to do with that one, but it gets better. V'hu haya hamispar hayoter mikudash etzel David. This was the most sacred number for David. David's go-to number is 5. U'mipnei zeh asa sefer tehillim b'chamisha sfarim chalukim. That's why when David composes Tehillim, it's actually 5 books. Tehillim is not one book. It has 5 units in it. So why are there 5 units? Because David wanted to make it parallel to the 5 chumashim. So David really likes 5. Tell me something. Does this ring a bell? David likes 5. Does this ring a bell? I hope it rings a bell for someone. Five stones. Thank you. Ricky got it. Five stones. You remember David went to fight against Goliath and he took five stones and we were like, what's with five stones? And we gave a few different explanations, you know, that were floated. And one of them was that it's one is to avenge Shaul and one is to avenge Hophni and Pinchas. And what, we gave all these different explanations. Abarbanel here says something he didn't say back in chapter 17. And in fact, he doesn't make the comment. He doesn't link them in 17. He doesn't link them here. But I don't understand why he didn't, because it's so obvious now. If David really likes the number five, so that's why he took five stones. It was David's number. David, you know, people have a lucky number, so David's number is five. I find this so strange, but I don't know what else to do with it. This is what it is. Yes, Susan.
Being practical, five loaves for David, because we know he's alone right now, are going to go back. Like, I don't know why he would have, unless he has people he knows he's going to catch up with. Five loaves in those days wouldn't last.
So you could say, it's as Malbin said, that he's keeping up the subterfuge. Right.
Okay.
That would be, you know, that could be an answer. We are going to see, God willing, not yet, but we will see that if it is the showbread, there are unique properties for the showbread in terms of its freshness. And maybe he's expecting that it'll stay fresh extra long. Keep in mind, if it's the showbread, it's already been on the table for a week. We have stuff to talk about in that regard. But before we get to the question of what bread this was, I have a different point. David is now becoming a more complicated figure for us. Right? Until now, until this chapter, David has two standout character traits. Number one, Emuna. He is 100% sure that Hashem is taking care of him every step of the way, no matter what. He can fight against Goliath. He can take the 100 arlot or 200 arlot of the Plishtim. He can do whatever it is. He has complete faith that God is taking care of him. That's number one. And number two is humility. Right? David is so humble. We first meet him in chapter 16, and he's bashful. He doesn't come out originally when they're bringing the brothers out to Shmuel. He's a shepherd, like many leaders. Then in chapter 16, in sentence 18, we learned he had a whole bunch of wonderful traits. He's wise, he's a warrior, he's good looking, if Admoni means that, right? We had that whole discussion. He's a musician, God is with him. And then in chapter 17, we saw that David is a believer above all else, right? He rejects armor. He makes these big speeches against Goliath. We don't need no weapons. We have God on our side. Hang in there, Ricky. In chapter 18, David is very innocent. He says, who am I to marry the king's daughter? I'm not worthy of that. And Hashem is with him, saving him from Shaul's spear without David even knowing anything is happening, right? The first times that Shaul wants to kill David, David doesn't even know. He moves and avoids the spear without even being aware of it. Right? That's who he is until you get to chapter 18. I see your hand, Ricky, but I want to go through this idea. In chapter 19, chapter 20, David starts to take the initiative apparently out of necessity, not just relying on God. He recruits Jehonatan to help him. He flees from Shaul's men with the help of Michal. He runs to Shmuel. Shmuel, please help me. He gets Jonathan to agree to let him go, right, in chapter 20. And there, in chapter 20, he had to lie for the first time, saying that, you know, we're having a family sacrifice. That continues here in a big way. And he's going to need to break other laws regarding the bread he's going to get from the Mishkan. Meaning, David is not qualified to be able to use this bread. This bread is sacred bread. We'll talk about which sacred bread it was. But he's not eligible. He's doing it in order to save his life. That's why he does it. And that's the justification, ultimately. But I'm not questioning that it's permitted. What David does is what is allowed. And we have many biblical models of people who are, to use the term in Hebrew, mishtadel, They engage in hishtadlus for the Ashkenazim. The people who do what they need to do, even when they are people of faith, right? We have people in Tanakh who do that. Can you give me an example of somebody? Ricky, I saw your hand before, and I want you to hold your comment from before. But can you give me an example of somebody in the Torah who is known for belief in God, and yet does something pretty shady in order to escape danger?
Yaakov.
So Janine says Abraham. A few people say Yaakov.
Yaakov.
Right.
I would say Abraham.
Rivka. Right. So first of all, let's start with Abraham and Sarah. Right? Abraham and Sarah just entered the land in order to fulfill Lech Lecha. There's a famine, and they go down to Egypt. Now, Hashem tells them to do that. Hashem says that they should do it. But the point is, Hashem doesn't want them to just rely on him for help. That's not what they're supposed to do. And then, of course, they lie to Paro to save Abraham's life. Yes, technically, we sandwich generations, and so she is his sister, because fine, all well and good. Nonetheless, you're engaged in hishtadlus. You're doing what you have to do. Rivka arranges for Yaakov to get the bracha, to get the blessing, because she says, well, that's what's supposed to happen, but it's a deception. Rachel takes the trafim from her father. Yaakov uses the strategy that a malach tells him to defeat Lavan regarding his salary, right? Consistently, down the line, you do what you need to do. So I'm not saying that David is sort of breaking with the pattern. David is consistent with something that we've seen. But I wonder, what lessons might David be taking here regarding political power? Right? How is doing this, and it's going to get much worse in this chapter, how is doing this going to affect David as a king? What is he learning here? Yes, Ricky.
It's what we're learning here. I think we're learning that yesterday you talked about animalities, but I think that we're learning, number one, that this makes him more of a rounded person, like a real person, instead of this paragon of perfection. And also that sometimes we just have to do what we have to do, and Hashem is still going to be with us. He's a person.
So that's one take for sure. That's one take for sure, is that you have to get your hands dirty sometimes, you know, certainly to save lives. That's one possibility. Janine, you were going to say?
We don't have any paragons of perfection. And so far he's been built up so much that now he says, okay, yeah, but he's also capable.
Oh, I can't wait till I get to the end of the chapter, because I'm going to totally turn this around on you. Janine, what were you going to say?
I just think he's been very timid till now, but he's now a future leader, and a leader has to be proactive. I think it's a maturing and maybe a growing into a new role.
Right, that Hashem is going to make you, I like the word you used, he's going to make you be proactive. And you're going to have to do it without Hashem's guidance. Hashem is not always going to tell you what you should do. You know, we've talked about with David, Hashem Imo, God is with him. And sometimes that doesn't mean that Hashem is going to tell you what to do. Maybe that's what David is supposed to be taking here. Other comments on that? Other suggestions for what David is learning? Yes, Effie.
Deception.
Well, that goes back to what Ricky had suggested, that he's learning to act in a way that is dirty in order to save lives. Maybe. But I want to come back to this at the end of the chapter, because we have to see the whole story, but we're going to look at this very, very differently by the end. If anyone, since we're going to be, you know, not doing this until after Sukkot, so it's a very long time. So my hint to you is to look at the chapters in Tehillim, in Psalms, that are associated with our chapter. There are a couple of chapters in Psalms that are associated with our chapter where David is in Nov. One of them you definitely, shouldn't say that. One of them should be familiar from the Shabbos morning davening, because it's one of the chapters that is said then. LeDavid b'shano soes tamo, when David is described as running away to Avimelech. So Avimelech is Achish in our chapter. So there are clues there as to what David is learning and not learning in this chapter. Ricky, you were going to ask something before earlier on this on.
Just tell us the number of Tehillim. You didn't tell us what numbers.
I didn't tell you because I don't remember offhand. I think it's 34, but I'm not sure. I think it might be 34.
It was a continuation of the other thought.
Yeah.
That I was learning, and then it sort of came together.
Okay. So I would say this. First of all, 56 is one of the chapters, and yes, 34 is the other chapter. Okay, those are the ones that you want to see. And they both connect to the end of this chapter and David running away to the Philistines. But you may look at that and see what I mean, and maybe not. But we'll see. God willing, we will come back to that. So David is seeking help from Achimelech. He's not telling him what's going on, whether maybe giving him an alibi, whether it's because he wants to be able to keep it secret when he asks God for advice via Achimelech. But he's not saying anything. He's asked for bread. Hey, do you have, I don't know, 5 loaves of bread? Because 5 is my lucky number. So what's going to happen next is that Achimelech is going to tell him what bread he has. Take a look at Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. He says, Vayana Kohen es David Vayomer. The Kohen answers David saying, Ein lechem chol el tachas yadi. I have no mundane bread available. There is no regular bread here. Kiem lechem kodesh yesh. The only thing we have is holy bread, sacred bread. Im nishmru ha-ne'arim ach me'isha. If the youths have been careful to stay away from a woman. What they're talking about with the woman is something that we'll get to eventually. We're not going to get to it today, but I gave you the reference on the sheet in source number 10. You can look up the pasuk. But it's the idea that having relations communicates a level of tum'ah, such that mikvah is required if someone is then going to eat from a sacrifice. So that's what he's saying. I have bread here that's holy. It's from a sacrifice. However, you have to make sure that you're not impure. If you have any tum'ah, you're not eligible. So you and he says your youths, but he really means David. He just doesn't want to insult David by saying it directly. That's what the commentator suggests. Yes, Janine. Sorry?
I was going to ask which now agreement he's talking about, because unless what we said before, we wanted to, sorry, my internet is unstable.
Oh. So is mine. Join the club.
You hear me.
I hear you now.
Okay.
So it's not David talking. It's Achimelech who thinks they really are youths. Achimelech is saying...
That would support what we said, that asking for 5...
Yeah.
...to make him think that he did have youths, because we see that he came alone.
Right. No, but David told him that there were youths already before. David said that to him before in sentence 3. That's where he's getting it from. So, the...
But he said his youths are not with them.
Right.
The youths went to some other place.
Right, and I'm bringing the bread to them. That will be that's the message. So, why doesn't Achimelech have regular bread? So, why can't he go ask? I mean, you're in a city. Why can't he go ask? So Radak says, the whole city is a city of Kohanim. Nov is a city of Kohanim. That we're gonna see very clearly in the next chapter. Their bread is made from grain, which is truma, which is a tithe that is given to the Kohanim. They don't have fields. They don't work fields. Their grain is given to them as a tithe, and therefore it is sacred, and a non-Kohen is not allowed to eat truma, and if he does, there's a severe penalty for it. So it's actually better halachically to get an offering, as he does, than to eat truma. Or Abarbanel says, no, it could be that Achimelech could have gone around in the city looking for bread, but that would have delayed David. And David does not want any delays. David needs to get on the road. He needs to make sure to get far away from Shaul. So that's why he's not walking around town to get David bread. So what he's going to do is give him bread that is Kodesh, that is holy, and that's where we're going to have to stop at this point, because of the next piece is to understand what kind of bread it was that David got, and that's a long discussion. So, God willing, next week we will have a shiur about Tzom Gedalia, and then we resume.